number 201715 and case number 201741, Dwayne Green et al. Versus Crawford County, Michigan et al. Is argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Radden, you may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Raid, on behalf of the Crawford County appellants and cross appellees. At this time, Your Honors, I would like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Very well.
Your Honors, I take great notice of what you just said about having prepared and read the briefs, and this is a well-briefed case and also includes a number of jail videos. So with that, Your Honors, this is a qualified immunity case, but also a deliberate indifference to a serious medical need case. Recently, the court has heard oral argument and issued a decision in the Bronner case, and I understand that's most likely the most topical thing before the court. But respectfully, I think that that case doesn't apply in this instance for a couple of reasons. First of all, as we know, Bronner extended the ruling in Kingsley beyond the excessive force case that Kingsley expressly spoke of, and somehow ruled that the subjective element of a deliberate indifference claim was no longer necessary. The problem with Justice White's opinion is that, first of all, as Justice Radler said in his dissent, there is still a subjective element, even under the new test that Justice White...
I mean, you should assume we're bound by it, whether we agree or not. I mean, my suggestion is you could argue in terms of how it applies here, but we can't change a prior published precedent.
Thank you, Your Honor. And
does it really make any difference in this case? Because even under the objective only standard, you still have to, plaintiff still has to establish recklessness. That's reckless conduct. Does the difference in standard, is it going to be dispositive here?
Not in this case, Your Honor.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. And so in this case, when we're analyzing the corrections officers, it might be easiest, rather than looking at them individually, to look at a point in time. We know that on December 7th, the morning of December 7th, Corrections Officer Foster initiated a request to community mental health.
Okay, my problem with Foster is, although he was granted qualified immunity, he knew when he went to work, when he was working on the 6th, that the mental health counselor had ruled out a mental health problem with Mr. Green. So therefore, we're left with a medical problem. And Foster knew that, but did not refer Green to a medical specialist, though he knew the mental health was not the factor. And that's the problem I have with the qualified immunity for Foster.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think you have the timing a little bit mixed up.
Isn't the cardiac arrest the morning of the 7th?
It was the 8th, Your Honor.
8th, okay. So, all right, I'm a day off here. So, but he did work the evening of the 7th.
He worked overnight on the 6th to the 7th.
Right.
Which is when he initiated the call to sit to.
But he also worked after the mental health counselor had left, and she had concluded that there was not a mental health problem. So we're left with a medical problem, and there's no medical care or treatment rendered to Mr. Green when Foster knows that's the only thing that could be wrong.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I'd have to look up when exactly Foster worked. I don't believe he worked on the 8th. But regardless, the mental health authority came in on the 7th, as you said.
Right.
And this court and courts have always held that a corrections officer or a police officer is entitled to rely on a healthcare professional's judgment
mental health. Right. She's not medical. That's the problem. And he either has a mental problem or he has a medical problem caused by the alcohol withdrawal. It's one or the other. and the mental aspect has been ruled out. So we're left with medical, and there's no medical care treatment rendered.
So, but by that standard, Your Honor, what we're asking the corrections officers to do is to somehow have more medical judgment, more medical or healthcare judgment than a trained professional.
So a trained professional is not a medical professional. It's like a psychologist or something here.
But Your Honor, this is the same issue that came up in the Meyer versus Presque Isle County case.
But she says she's not even trained in medical fields, and she's not qualified to render
a recommendation
as to medical conditions. She's a mental counselor.
I think the challenge here is that we're focusing specifically on Nancy Karshevsky's qualifications. C.O. Foster or anybody at the jail did not contact Nancy Karshevsky. They contacted community mental health. If she was not qualified, that's not an issue for the jail.
Community mental health doesn't render medical opinions, does it?
Well, yes, in some instances they had. And in the past practice, there is evidence in the record.
They're not medical doctors. They're not medical
Certainly
nurses.
Not, Your Honor. But plaintiff makes much of the fact that community mental health is the organization that trained these officers on areas of mental health, including touching on delirium tremens. And when these officers...
Touching on it to the extent that, hey, this is, you know, a physical problem, not a mental one, presumably.
Presumably, certainly,
and,
Your Honor.
And but oftentimes a fatal one.
Certainly.
I mean, to be honest with you, I can't tell you how many of these cases I've had where somebody dies in a jail cell right in front of officers observing. And sometimes those persons have a culpable mindset, and sometimes they don't. But I think Judge Griffin's recitation is accurate, as I understand it. And so I think the challenge you face with Officer Foster, among others, is that a jury could find that he knows this is a medical problem and that this person is not receiving medical treatment. And I think he knows that this withdrawal condition is very dangerous. And so, you know, how is it okay to just sit there and do nothing until he's dead?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honors, they didn't just do nothing. They did what the Community Mental Health Authority told them to do, which was keep him in observation, make sure he's eating and drinking, and if something else happens, to contact them.
Well, what's something else? I mean, he's talking about he's on a construction crew. He's doing all kinds of things that are, you know, like there's something seriously wrong, obviously, and it's probably DT. I mean, I'm sure this is not their first, prisoner who's had DT.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but the case law also says that ordinary alcohol withdrawal is not a serious medical need. Delirium tremens certainly is. We don't have anything in the record that demonstrates when Mr. Green switched from being drunk to being undergoing ordinary withdrawal to being experiencing delirium tremens. The hallucination.
I thought there was all kinds of testimony about him doing extremely bizarre things the night before he died. His cellmate or whatever says he's screaming the whole night. He's, totally delusional about where he is and what he's doing. Does none of that reach the officers? Is that?
Well, I'm sure there's definitely conflicting testimony about how he
behaved. And that's why things go to a jury. Usually.
But, Your Honors, beyond that, the case law in this circuit says that the officer is allowed to rely on the professional judgment of a healthcare professional.
But there's a wrong level of generality here. I mean, that just fuzzes it up a bit. I mean, if you're talking about like a paramedic or something, that's one thing. But with respect to Foster, and I think some of the others, they know specifically this person's not a medical treater. They're a psychological treater, mental health, but not a, physical health.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I don't believe that's accurate. I mean, the community mental health had sent a variety of different types of people in that capacity to come and evaluate prisoners. And in the past practice, they had made recommendations to get healthcare treatment, medical treatment. There is ample evidence in the record that they had always, not always, but they had in the past relied on recommendations. And when they were uncertain whether things were medical or mental or what to do, they contacted community mental health.
Mr. Reddy, I think we're spending an awful lot of time on trying to figure out what they were not entitled to rely upon when the mental health evaluation was done. The problem, it seems to me, is that the nurse only came to the jail on Friday, and Mr. Green was seems to me a reasonable jury could conclude that his condition was deteriorating after the mental health worker was there, regardless of what role you consider her to have been playing. They knew the nurse wasn't going to come in until Friday, yet they didn't do anything after this person was getting worse. So how do we just overlook that? If the condition had stayed exactly the same, then we might be more worried about what the nurse's qualifications were and whether she was doing medical or mental. But I don't see how, in the final analysis, it really matters.
Well, I see my time is up. If I could answer your question and then briefly conclude, Your Honor. The mental health authority evaluated Green on the 7th. It was the morning of the 8th when he passed away. So in that short, approximately 18-hour window, the corrections officers, including Chrisman, and I'm not sure if it was Foster, but some of the others, continued to monitor Green, and they adhered to what community mental health instructed them to do. They did exactly what they told him. He's just going through alcohol withdrawal. Keep him calm. Make sure he's eating and drinking. And if something else arises, something changes, to contact them. Nothing changed. His condition stayed the same until he unfortunately had the cardiac incident. With that, Your Honors, I don't believe that the Bronner case moves the needle in this particular instance. The officers were not deliberately indifferent. There's no evidence in the record that they were recklessly disregarding it. Instead, even if they did the wrong thing, even if this court were to find they did the wrong thing, they did something. They did what they thought was right, and as such, they're entitled to qualified immunity because cannot be said that no reasonable officer in their position would have done the same.
Okay. All right, you'll have your 2 minutes rebuttal. Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Douglas Curlew on behalf of the Northern Lakes Community Mental Health Authority, Appalese.
Let's see, does your client render medical advice?
They do not, and they cannot.
I didn't think so.
By statute, they're specifically precluded from doing that. Now, I'm kind of under attack from both sides, as you'll know from the briefs and from the argument. I want to touch just specifically
Let me ask you one specific question before you do that. Mr. Ratai said that your worker basically gave a medical advice by saying that they should continue to observe this guy. And I was just looking through at least my notes, and I don't see that. I just see that she said that he wasn't experiencing a mental problem, and so therefore he wasn't a danger to himself for mental problems. So which is it?
That's exactly where I was going to start, Your Honor. He talks about this observation with something that Nancy Karczewski suggested. No, Nancy Karczewski did exactly what she was told to do. She told him, this is not a mental problem. It's delirium tremens. They know it's a mental problem. He's not at risk to himself, of harm to himself or others. That's what she was asked to do. That's what she's licensed to do. That's what she did. Says they adhered to her advice was what was said. No, what they adhered to was their own policy. If you look in my brief, I state repeatedly where it was said in the record by Bearlocker, by Corporal Tessner, by Corporal Chrisman, Bearlocker being the administrator, that our policy is to observe people in this condition. So Nancy Karczewski has told them he's got the medical condition, delirium tremens. He is not at risk of harm from harming himself or harming others. That's what she does. She goes on her way. What they do then is they adhere to their own policy, which is simply to observe. As Tessner and Chrisman both said, we've never in our experience called medical help for an alcohol withdrawal. We just observe them and have never had to do it. They were following their own policy, not anything that Nancy Karczewski told them to do. Now, plaintiff as well has suggested that Karczewski was making medical recommendations. That's the other thing I wanted to hit on. If you look in my brief, it's in there. There were only three evidentiary things stated as to Nancy Karczewski ever saying anything about medical issues at the jail. One was, it was said by Chrisman, she will often communicate to us something that she has been told by a detainee or inmate. The only instance actually on record is that an inmate told her she had a black toe and she communicated to the jail. He says he got a black toe. That's one. Two, she once asked if they would had checked the medication for a bipolar condition, which is mental. Third, she's made referrals for substance abuse treatment, mental condition, not for any kind of medical treatment. So that's just completely off the table.
It does seem sort of odd here that regardless of what the scope of her practice is, that she wouldn't at least make a suggestion that, hey, this guy's got a real problem here. You ought to do something about it, as opposed to telling him what the treatment should be. My problem is, assuming that I'm right about that, it does seem to me that that's at least negligent on her part. So the real question is, does that rise to the level of a constitutional violation? But why wouldn't she have at least made a suggestion?
Well, first, it doesn't rise to the level of the recklessness, which is the standard now, not negligence. But I was thinking about that myself, and I said to myself, you know, she can identify that it's delirium tremens, but she testified specifically, and it's in the brief with details as to where in the record it's found, that she had no knowledge medically of what delirium tremens actually requires as far as treatment, and wouldn't have known whether it was actually required medical intervention or not. It's like I can identify a magnolia tree, but I have no idea how to plant one or grow one just because I can identify the condition. She knows what it is, but there's no evidence in the record that she had any ability to know whether it required medical intervention. After all, the jail's policy, and they're the ones who are responsible for undertaking the medical once they're told, is we've never called for an alcohol withdrawal situation. It doesn't need medical. You know, they've never gotten to the point where they thought it needed medical, and there's no evidence in the record that delirium tremens necessarily requires intervention or that she would have known it. I don't know it. Perhaps I'm just clueless. But would a reasonable person have known that there was a need for medical intervention in this case? I don't think there's any evidence in the record from which to say that that's something we can say as a matter of law. As far as the Community Mental Health Authority itself, what can they train people to do? They're basing their claim against them on the training. There's no basis for them to try to train their people to do things that are outside their scope of practice or outside their authority even. There was the comment in an appellant's brief, that you should see something and you should do something. And what was they should do? They claimed that they should have made sure the jail obtained medical assistance or summon it themselves. Nancy Karczewski and North Valley Community Health have no authority to do that.
There's no duty either. That's the problem.
They have no duty.
Even if that would be a good idea to have legal liability, there has to be a legal duty.
Correct.
I don't see a duty for the community health to give advice as to medical.
With that, I have no need to take more of the court's time unless there's further questions.
All right. Let's hear from the plaintiff's counsel. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Seema Patel on behalf of Plaintiff Appellee's Cross Appellant. At counsel table, I have Mr. Kevin Riddle, who is trial counsel. I'm going to start my argument off with the Crawford County's argument and talking about when is it reasonable to rely on a medical professional's recommendation. And I think there are two parts. In every case that I have looked at, there are two elements that thread through both of them. And that is, all of them, and that is, one is reasonable reliance on a medical recommendation. Here, you don't have either of those. I think that the court understands this issue very well, and I can go through some of the cases, but I did a thorough review of every single case that I could find dealing with this in this circuit and outside, and I couldn't find a single one where reliance on Nancy Karczewski is a limited licensed professional counselor. She's a limited licensed counselor, so she has very specific things that she can do to provide mental health assessment, and that's it. She's not qualified to provide any medical judgment. She's not provided. She's not qualified to make any type of medical recommendation. So, with that being said, The salient inquiry is it reasonable for them to, for Crawford County as a whole and these individual defendants to have relied on her assessment of Mr. Green for 15 minutes? And I think it's not. I was saying before, I've looked
the,
at-
The problem with your argument is that you can catch yourself coming and going here, because when you say you can't find a single case, then at least some of our minds go straight to clearly established. And so when we're addressing the qualified immunity for a lot of these folks, why was it clearly established in this case that they were not entitled to rely upon this community mental health person, even though we all understand that her primary responsibility, or exclusive perhaps, was mental?
So I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't finish my thought. When I said I couldn't find a single case, the second part of that was that I couldn't find a single case where the court had applied this reliance on a medical judgment or medical recommendation that involved reliance on somebody who lacked the qualifications or had the qualifications that Ms. Karczewski did. So when you're looking at qualified immunity, the salient inquiry is, was this objectively reasonable and was it clearly established? Well, it's not objectively reasonable because nobody would rely on a mental health provider to give a judgment on a medical assessment. And then in terms of whether it's clearly...
Well, is that really that clear in this record, in the sense that they relied upon community mental health to actually put on training, and that training included delirium tremens?
The training included delirium tremens, but it clearly stated also that this is a medical issue and community mental health is
My point is, if the jail officials know that they're actually delivering training on a medical issue, even though their responsibility is mental, why is it that unreasonable for a jail official to think that, whether it's within her scope of practice or not, she's going to tell them something if she thinks it's delirium tremens and they're not doing what they're supposed to do?
Well, she didn't tell them anything. She came in, she did an assessment because he was hallucinating, and she said, okay, this is a mental health, this is not a mental health issue, and then she left. That was the...
I don't think you're grasping perhaps the subtlety of what I'm asking, because you're addressing both what community mental health did and you're addressing what the jail officials did or didn't do. I'm just asking you why it isn't reasonable for the jail officials to rely upon what they say they thought was community mental health's responsibility, given that they trained on this particular condition.
I don't think training on the, they didn't train, they trained on delirium tremens. They got training on what the system was and what the diagnosis is and what to look out for. They weren't trained on what to do. What the training provided was, if you see these symptoms, you need to call a medical provider. So that training, while it was given by the mental health authority, did not go into the medical assessment like, okay, if you see this, then you need to provide XYZ medical services. What it did was, if you see hallucinations, if you see someone who's disoriented, if you see someone who is not eating, not sleeping, et cetera, what you need to do is contact medical. And then also with that training, and also the testimony bears out, is that everybody understood that CMH was provided mental health, that they weren't medical. Bear Loker's testimony is pretty clear on that, that he understood that you don't put a Band-Aid on, they don't put a Band-Aid on things. So I think that that testimony bears, is important, because then it goes to, well, was it reasonable for them to say, okay, even though community mental health put on this training and talked about this issue of delirium tremens and something that can come up in the context of a correctional setting, is it then reasonable to rely on people who are designated to only provide mental health to deal with something that the training itself says is medical, and then that it's not medical?
How about Judge McKeague's question about clearly established? Is there, you've read the cases, is there a case that you would point us toward that whose facts would have given some guidance to the defendant officers here?
Yeah, so I think that looking through all of these cases, the thread running through all of them in terms of reliance
kind
on
of looking for
opinion,
a name of a case at
yeah,
this point.
The recent case unpublished out of this court, Stajewski, sorry if I butchered the name, v. Macomb County, that talks about when it is reasonable what your what the duty is for correctional officers in terms of be looking out for, and that if there is a significantly worsened condition or a condition that is ongoing, that there is an ongoing duty, even if medical has been summoned to provide an assessment, just summoning that medical doesn't obviate any future obligation.
So are there any delirious tremens cases that you think would have warned the officers here that they needed to do something?
I think the prior case goes into delirium tremens. That was the prior v. City v. Ferndale, and that dealt with someone who was going through delirium tremens and diabetes. In that case, I think it's significant because the officers, like the plaintiff or the decedent, was seen by paramedics. He was apprehended, he was seen by paramedics. The paramedics called doctors on call at the hospital and got a treatment plan from the hospital. So there was actually medical judgment that was rendered and medical advice that was provided. Regardless of that, he continued to not feel well, continued to go through the DTs, and was, I think, vomiting profusely, had profuse diarrhea, and eventually got dehydrated and kind of collapsed in his cell. And in that case, this court held that the defendants, who were corrections officers, were not entitled to qualified immunity because of this ongoing medical condition. So I think that case is probably one that is as closely to
ours. That's good, thank you.
I wanted to also address the two cases that defendants rely most heavily on, which are the Meyer case and the McGaugh case. And in both of those cases, I think there's a stark difference with the circumstances that we have in ours, which is that there was consultation with medical providers. In the McGaugh case, we had the officers had summoned the jail nurse, who was an LPN, and she conferred with her supervisor, created a treatment plan, and then executed that treatment plan. So there was reliance on a medical professional's opinion, and not only that, but an opinion that had been vetted by a superior. Same thing in Meyer. The corrections officers had called a doctor and complied with the doctor's orders in terms of treating after, I think, they conveyed the vital signs and conveyed how the decedent was doing. So there's not a single case that I could find that had similar circumstances as here, which is that a person, or where, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say similar. I couldn't find a case where qualified immunity was granted in the circumstances where corrections officers stood by and watched a man go through delirium tremens, understood that it was a serious medical condition, because the testimony of the officers, if you take it bit by bit, establishes that they did understand that this was a medical condition, it was a serious medical condition, and their modus operandi was to sit back, watch, and hope that he would get better. And unfortunately, he didn't get better.
But and have you found a single case that goes the other way, that ruled that not appropriate? I mean, it's your burden to but their defense of qualified immunity. It's not theirs. Once they raise qualified immunity, you have to come forth with all reasonable officers would know that conduct that they have to go through. What's the best case you have?
Well, the prior case that I talked about a few minutes ago, I think the Sojewski case is also very, very favorable to our position. And so, I rely on those two cases, and also just the facts of this case and what the rubric of analyzing a constitutional claim is, which is under deliberate indifference, is like a obvious serious medical need. I think there's no question that he was undergoing a serious medical need. And then now, under Bronner, the recklessness standard, did each of these individual defendants witness, did they know or should have known that he was undergoing a serious medical condition, and did they ignore it? And they did. I think that's the record establishes that beyond a doubt. The caveat, I think, that what defendants had based their argument on was this exception of, oh, well, we can reasonably rely on a medical provider's medical recommendation. And that exception, so to speak, doesn't apply because you don't have reasonable reliance and you don't have a medical recommendation.
Okay. Now, we look at each defendant individually. What did each defendant know or should have known? And your cross appeal is in regard to the defendants that were granted qualified immunity. Could you just briefly run by what evidence you think you have in support of your cross appeal as to those particular defendants?
Absolutely. So there were four. With respect to Foster, I think, Your Honor, you touched on it with when Brother Counsel.
I think we've talked about
okay,
Foster.
Okay, so Foster is good. The other three, we have Souter, Stuffies, and Avalos. And I think that the Bronner decision is significant in analyzing the claims against these individuals.
Okay, so do you think Bronner has an impact on the result as to that cross appeal, then, that it affects it? Whether we apply the holding of Broader or what Judge Radler characterizes as dicta, do you think that's positive, that's going to make a difference here?
No, I personally think that I think that we meet even if we were going to follow the subjective okay. standard for deliberate indifference.
All right, so you kind of agree with them. It doesn't matter. Under either standard, you think you win.
I do think we win under either standard. I think the standard under Bronner now is the recklessness standard. But even under either standard, we have a lot of circumstantial evidence from which you can infer that these individuals subjectively knew that Mr. Green was undergoing a serious medical condition, that he was in the throes of DTs, exhibiting all of these symptoms, and that these symptoms were ignored. And I can point to the fact that there was a custom and practice of briefing, that the jail was a small jail. I think that it was like a 37-person jail, that Mr. Green was kept in the observation cells the entire time he was there. So anybody who was in that area and a corrections officer working would have seen and done that, known that.
The problem with your argument, if I could interrupt, is that
sure.
Judge Griffin asked you about these three specific defendants, and you haven't said anything about the three specific defendants. And one of them, I'll just use this as an example, is Avalos. He was on duty on the 4th and the 5th, and the judge specifically found that he wasn't exhibiting delirium tremens on those 2 days. It didn't manifest itself until the third day he was in the jail. And then he was only on duty 90 minutes prior to Mr. Green collapsing, and there's no evidence that suggested that he had observed him during that period. So just using him as an example of why we're asking you this question, what do you point to with respect to Avalos?
So with respect to Avalos, again, it's the fact that the jail was very small. It was a 37-person jail. Mr. Green was kept in those observation rooms, which any corrections officer who was working would have observed, and the fact that he was exhibiting such overt signs of distress, being that he was moving to Traverse City or going to hike to Traverse City, he was hallucinating, he was not, so it is circumstantial evidence.
Did you even ask him whether he walked by the observation cell and saw this guy?
I can't remember, Your Honor. I can't remember the...
All right, so you don't have any specific, you don't have any direct evidence. It's all circumstantial.
It is circumstantial.
It's a small
evidence.
Jail, so therefore he must have known what everybody else knows. Is that
well,
correct?
And the custom and practice of the fact that he would have been briefed about the Mr. Green's condition at the beginning of the shift, and that we do have testimony about that. But yes, that's the circumstantial evidence from which, if you look at it in our favor, leads to the reasonable inference that he subjectively did know that that Mr. Green was undergoing serious delirium tremens and that it ignored that risk.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Rebuttal?
Your Honor, something Mr. Curlew said really and then something that Ms. Patel said as well. There is no dispute that these officers at least adhered to the policy of the jail. They did what they thought was right. So in 2 minutes, I really can't go through each one of these individually. But to say that they were deliberately indifferent in hindsight, we can say maybe they should have done something differently. But to say they were deliberately indifferent flies in the face of what they actually did. Each of these officers who observed Mr. Green did something to make sure he was comfortable, to observe him, to make sure that he was eating and drinking. Those are the things that the policy requires. Now, if we later say that the policy should have been something else, that's a different issue.
But there clearly becomes a line beyond which you have to do something more than observing and making sure they're eating and drinking. Would you agree with that?
I would, Your Honor.
So the question here under these facts is where do we draw the line? And do we draw that line, or does the jury draw that line?
Well, and with that point, Your Honor, and not to belabor the issues we were talking about on my initial argument, but there isn't a single case out there where the court splits hairs between medical specialties. There's been a lot of focus on what Ms. Karshevsky's
medical
qualifications.
Medical specialties?
I mean, any healthcare specialties, for lack of a better.
Mental health is different than medical? I mean, I don't think we're splitting hairs. I think they're drastically different, aren't they?
No, Your Honor. There's
a medical doctor and a psychiatrist are a psychiatrist actually is a doctor. A psychologist.
That's my point, Your Honor.
Psychologist. Or how about a mental health counselor? Yeah. A limited, what's her title?
A social worker.
Yeah.
Limited practice.
Well, with due respect, Your Honor.
You're going to compare her to a medical doctor?
No, I'm not going to compare her at all, Your Honor.
Well, I don't think it's splitting hairs. I think somebody that has a medical degree is got a lot more expertise.
Well, unless this court is willing to say that they must call the doctor and couldn't rely on a nurse or any other any healthcare professional. Okay. In this case, Your Honors, they contacted community mental health, who in the past had trained them on this issue and had directed medical treatment be done. The fact that it was Ms. Karshevsky is beside the point.
The interesting part about that, and I was intrigued by that too, but then looking at what each of the officers testified to, they said that they contacted community mental health for a mental evaluation.
Sure.
They didn't say for a medical evaluation.
Well,
so,
at the time,
so apparently that was a meaningful distinction to them.
Well, at the time, well, that was the question. At the time, they had been, the condition, or excuse me, the manifestations, if you will, were limited to hallucinations. That's all Mr. Green was demonstrating. The erratic behavior, as Corporal Christman testified, all of that was bundled into one. He was being erratic because he was hallucinating. It wasn't separate incidents or separate conditions. He was hallucinating. So they contacted who they thought they should, and they relied on what she told them. It's not true to say that she said, this is beyond my scope and this is medical and contact somebody else. No, what she said was, he's undergoing alcohol withdrawal. Keep an eye on him and let me know if things change. Let us know if things change. To these officers, each one of them cared about this inmate and did what they thought was right.
So implicit in what you just said is you don't think the record establishes that his condition did change after she looked at him, correct?
Correct. I think it's clear in the record.
So if we find that it looks like there's evidence, if believed, that his condition did change and did worsen, then that would significantly change your argument, would it not?
Well, it depends on to the degree. I mean, there is it is very rare cases, I think is the quote, and I don't have the case in front of me, but it's very rare that an officer who relies on the course of treatment, for lack of a better term, or the recommendations of a healthcare professional, there has to be a dramatic change. The case that Ms. Patel cited, the individual was dehydrating, had extreme
at a
diarrhea.
Minimum, isn't there an issue of fact as to that and an appeal of qualified immunity? We can't get into the facts. In fact, we have no jurisdiction if you challenge the facts as set forth by the plaintiff.
Well, except when they're blatantly contradicted by the record evidence. And in this case, we have jail videos. There is absolutely nothing on the videos or any testimony that shows that Mr. Green's condition changed from when Ms. Karshevsky evaluated him until he passed away.
That's really not my review of the record. I thought it worsened considerably. I
mean, this is not the Scott case. Everybody wants to say their case is the Scott case. Scott case.
Okay. Well, I'm not, and to your point, Your Honor, I'm not arguing the facts. I appreciate what you're saying. I think that with qualified immunity, what they did was objectively reasonable, and if this court were to say it wasn't, it certainly wasn't clearly established in December of 2017 that relying on the course of treatment by the organization that trained these officers on this particular issue was somehow unreasonable.
Okay. Any further questions? Ms. Patel, I granted you a couple minutes rebuttal on your cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This doesn't have to do with the cross appeal, but I found the citation to the Avalos dep, if you'd
all
want
right.
me to.
All right, no, we'll take it.
Okay. On page 24 of his deposition, he testifies that, do you remember at any time on the 8th, did you observe Dwayne Green and what you would recall hallucinations? I answer, he was walking around in the cell with a blanket in his hand. Did you observe him talking with the blanket? I can't recall if he was talking. So regardless of whether we can get to...
This is within that period of 90 minutes
yes.
before...
Right. Yep, it's in the morning of the 8th before he passed became unconscious. So that's the site I was going to provide with you. Also, very quickly, as to the Northern Lakes Community Mental Health, our claims against them, I disagree with you, Judge Griffin, that Nancy Karczewski did not have a duty to do something. She was there at the jail acting as a state actor. She was called to provide services as a state actor. And I understand that, you know, in terms of what she was being asked to do, the scope of her practice was to provide a mental health assessment. However, as with any layperson who is a state actor, if you see something, you do have an obligation to do something. I don't think there's any question, based on her note and what she stated, that she understood that delirium tremens was a serious medical condition. She understood that it required medical aid. But
do you have a case that says what you're saying?
Not that I can think of, Your Honor. I'm sorry. But, well, it's the I'm relying on
limited health professional. She has to stay within her scope of practice.
Well,
so do you have a case that says that in connection with a medical or mental professional, that they then have a duty to go outside their scope of practice, which would violate their license?
I'm relying on the line of cases that says you don't have to be a medical professional or a mental health professional or in order to be deliberately indifferent to a serious medical need. That's why we have this line of cases that say that corrections officers, who are lay people, they don't need to have any type of medical
corrections
assessment.
Officers don't have a limited scope of practice. They don't have a license that limits what they can do.
I see what you say. Okay. But I think that our argument is not that she needs to violate her license and say that she needs to act outside of that scope of that license. I think that it puts her on the same footing as a corrections officer as anybody who doesn't have a license but is still acting as an arm of the state. And to say, okay, if you see that somebody is going through DTs.
This is all a very compelling common sense argument that it's hard to argue with that. But how can you say it's clearly established?
I think, again, I rely on the line of cases that say that even a layperson can be deliberately indifferent to a serious medical need if that need is so obvious. And in terms of what duty do you have to do, something. You like make sure that the corrections officers know that medical aid should be called or call medical aid yourself. With that, thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the time.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The case will be submitted. Thank you for your arguments. Also, thank you for coming to Cleveland.